and the fact that it was showing up in science fiction magazines didn't help either. So Wheeler publicly distanced himself from Everett's work and DeWitt's spin on it. Everett's infinitely many unobservable worlds make a heavy load of metaphysical baggage, Wheeler wrote in 1979. Though Wheeler had always strongly supported Everett's physics career, and was still interested in Everett returning to academia after his 20 years in industry, he claimed that he had never supported Everett's ideas. Wheeler told me that he was always implacably opposed to the theory. What he supported was Everett, said David Deutsch, who was a young researcher at Austin when Everett came to speak there. Shortly thereafter, Wheeler started promoting his own ideas about an information-based interpretation of quantum physics, ideas that he saw as compatible with the Copenhagen interpretation. But Deutsch and many of the younger attendees at Everett's seminar in Austin were enthusiastic about the many-worlds interpretation. Deutsch sat next to Everett at lunch in a beer garden after the talk. Everett was full of nervous energy, high-strung, extremely smart, very much in tune with the issues of the interpretation of quantum mechanics, Deutsch recalled. He was extremely enthusiastic about many universes, and very robust as well as subtle in its defense, and he did not speak in terms of relative states or any other euphemism. Several years later, in his seminal paper on quantum computing, Deutsch claimed that only the many-worlds interpretation could explain the fabulous increase in speed that quantum computers offered. The Everett interpretation explains well how the quantum computer's behavior follows from its having delegated subtasks to copies of itself in other universes, Deutsch wrote. When the quantum computer succeeds in performing two processor days of computation, how would the conventional interpretations explain the presence of the correct answer? Where was it computed? Other interpretations of quantum physics would also prove capable of explaining the power of quantum computers. Nonetheless, Deutsch's enthusiasm was infectious, and many worlds soon gained in popularity within the new field of quantum information processing. Many worlds also continued to gain in popularity among physicists who took cosmology seriously, and even inspired new interpretations. Measurements and observers cannot be fundamental notions in a theory that seeks to discuss the early universe when neither existed, wrote Murray Gell-Mann and James Hartle in 1990. Gell-Mann had won a Nobel Prize in 1969 for suggesting the existence of quarks. Hartle, his former student, had done work on quantum cosmology with Stephen Hawking. Both had long been convinced that the Copenhagen interpretation had to be wrong. The fact that an adequate philosophical presentation of quantum physics has been so long delayed is no doubt caused by the fact that Niels Bohr brainwashed a whole generation of theorists, Gell-Mann wrote in 1976. Gell-Mann and Hartle combined Everett's interpretation with the work on decoherence done by Tse, Jos, and Zurich, along with ideas from Roland Omnay and Robert Griffiths, to develop what they called the decoherent histories interpretation of quantum physics. Despite the fact that their interpretation had a single world, Gell-Mann and Hartle acknowledged their intellectual debt to Everett and saw their ideas as an extension of his work. But Everett didn't live to see Gell-Mann's work, or Deutsch's. On July 19, 1982, Everett died of a heart attack at the age of 51. In accordance with his wishes, his family had him cremated and left his ashes out with the trash. Within a decade of Everett's death, cosmology entered a golden age. For much of the previous century, the field had been driven primarily by theoretical advances, such as the development of general relativity in the first place. But in the 1990s, the Hubble Space Telescope, the Cosmic Microwave Background Explorer, and other space-based observatories, complemented by a new generation of enormous terrestrial telescopes, flooded cosmologists with data. Around the same time, the advent of high-speed computing made it possible not only to process this data, but to simulate the entire universe, testing out different theories about its composition and behavior. cosmology rapidly went from guessing some of the most fundamental properties of the universe to nailing them down with shocking precision. In 1996, estimates for the age of the universe ranged from 10 to 20 billion years, much as they had for the three decades since Penzias and Wilson had discovered the CMB. By 2006, the age of the universe had been pinned down to 13.8 billion years, give or take a percent. With that precision came new pictures of the universe. The Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, WMAP, a space telescope launched in 2000, created a detailed map of the tiny differences in intensity in the CMB, which is uniform to about one part in 100,000. That map lent support to a theory of the extremely early universe at the time of the Big Bang, known as inflation. Inflation, first proposed by the physicist Alan Guth in 1981 and refined by Andreas Albrecht and André Linde shortly thereafter, says that the very early universe expanded extraordinarily quickly for a minuscule fraction of a second, increasing in size by a factor of about 100 trillion trillion in about a billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, then resumed expanding much more slowly. This rapid expansion was driven by hypothetical inflatons, high-energy subatomic particles which decayed into normal matter at the end of inflation. Crucially, the theory dictated that tiny quantum fluctuations in the density of inflatons were blown up by the inflation process, and then led to the tiny fluctuations in the density of normal matter in the small, hot universe immediately after inflation. Those fluctuations led, in turn, to the fluctuations in the CMB, and ultimately seeded the formation of all structure in the universe today, including our own galaxy and Earth itself. In short, inflation suggested that we are all the products of quantum fluctuations that occurred in the very early universe, and WMAP's data suggested inflation was right. WMAP's data supports the notion that galaxies are nothing but quantum mechanics writ large across the sky, Brian Green said in 2006. This is one of the marvels of the modern scientific age. But the Copenhagen interpretation couldn't explain how the early universe worked, and the mathematics of quantum physics couldn't handle such situations either. The early universe was fabulously small, suggesting that quantum physics was needed, but also fabulously dense, requiring the forbidding mathematical machinery of general relativity. Unfortunately, a theory unifying general relativity with quantum physics hadn't been found, despite having been sought for decades by an army of physicists, including Einstein. As late as the 1960s, some people had suggested that no such unification was necessary. Leon Rosenfeld had said, like a good positivist, that because quantum gravitational effects could never be seen, there was no need to develop a theory to address such unobservable phenomena. But as general relativity became more reputable, the need to unify it with quantum field theory had become more pressing. By the 1990s, ideas like Rosenfeld's were as far outside the mainstream of physics research as the old claims that cosmology shouldn't be taken seriously. A theory of quantum gravity, now nicknamed a theory of everything, was widely considered to be the single most important unsolved problem in all of physics. The most promising candidate was string theory, whose abstruse mathematics yielded glimpses of elegant connections between quantum physics and general relativity. By the early 2000s, combining string theory and inflation seemed like the best hope for a theory of the early universe. Surprisingly, both string theory and inflation, which were developed quite independently, seemed to point to a common conclusion: the existence of a multiverse, an enormous number of multiple independent universes. According to inflation, the universe is unable to escape eternal inflation. As inflation ends in one part of the universe, it continues in others, and bubbles of non-inflating universe continually appear in the inflating region. We live in one of these bubbles. Other bubbles would be their own universes, cut off from all the others. And each might have its own laws of physics and assortment of fundamental particles. And because inflation is eternal, there would be an infinity of these bubbles, an infinite multiverse of inflation. String theory, meanwhile, doesn't describe a single universe, but instead describes a string landscape, a phenomenally huge number of possible universes, 10 to the 500th power or more. The similarities to the many worlds interpretations multiverse were not lost on quantum cosmologists. The appearance of multiverses independent of Everett's interpretation made its strange profusion of worlds downright appealing. Some physicists even proposed that all three of these multiverses, Everettian multiworlds, eternal inflation, and the string landscape, were in fact a single multiverse, and the three theories were simply describing the same reality in different ways. In any case, the many worlds interpretation was, mostly, no longer laughed out of the room without serious consideration. Indeed, by the start of the 21st century, many worlds had become the most popular rival to the Copenhagen interpretation itself among physicists, with particular popularity among cosmologists. But with wider consideration came the realization of a new problem, one that any theory with an infinite multiverse faced, the problem of probability. At its core, the measurement problem asks when wave functions obey the deterministic harmony of the Schrödinger equation and when they undergo the random process of collapse. The many worlds interpretation gets around the measurement problem by denying that wave function collapse happens at all. In the multiverse of many worlds, the wave function of the universe always obeys the Schrödinger equation, splitting off into an endless series of branches that constitute the many worlds. But there's a problem with this picture. It's not clear how randomness and probability enter our quantum physics experiments if the universal wave function really does obey the Schrödinger equation at all times, since that equation is completely deterministic, with no element of chance. After all, one thing that absolutely everyone agrees on, no matter what interpretation or incoherent pseudo-interpretation they subscribe to, is that the outcomes of quantum physics experiments have an element of randomness. In general, the mathematical machinery of quantum physics only lets us predict the probabilities of particular experimental outcomes, rather than stating with certainty that a particular thing will happen. But if the entire universe is deterministically obeying a single equation, how can probability enter into physics at all? Normally, we think of probability as being like rolling a die. There are six outcomes. You can only get one. So the odds of any particular outcome are 1 in 6, unless the die is weighted. The probability of rolling an odd number on a die is 3 in 6, because there are 3 ways to get that outcome out of 6 total possible outcomes. See figure 11.1a. But probability in the many worlds interpretation can't work that way. With Schrödinger's cat, there are 2 possible outcomes. The cat is either alive or dead. So it's tempting to think the probability of either outcome is 1 in 2, 50%. But say we had set up the experiment slightly differently. Say we hadn't left the cat in there quite so long, out of some belated sense of mercy, and the probability of radioactive decay, and thus a dead cat, was only 25% rather than 50%. Now we have a problem. There are still 2 possible outcomes, but quantum physics dictates that they have unequal probabilities. There's a 75% chance that the cat is alive and a 25% chance that the cat is dead. But there's still just 2 branches, each inhabited by nearly identical versions of you. Is the copy of you in the dead cat branch somehow less real than the copy of you in the living cat branch? How do we make sense of this? It gets worse. This is just one experiment, and it's a big universe out there. In fact, in any reasonable understanding of Everett's interpretation, there's an infinity of branches on the universal wave function. How can we make sense of probabilities when there's an infinite number of copies of ourselves? The only reason we can calculate probabilities for our dice throws is that we can count the number of possible outcomes. This approach doesn't work in an infinite multiverse, because the numbers involved are always infinite. If we want to know the number of branches in which a particular event occurs, say, the number of branches of the universal wave function where you're reading this book right now, the answer will always be infinite. And the number of branches in which you are not reading this book is also infinite. So what's the probability in the multiverse that a randomly chosen version of you would be reading some version of this book? What does the fraction infinity over infinity come out to? See figure 11.1b. There are entire branches of mathematics devoted to dealing with infinity, and they tell us that such fractions can equal nearly anything at all. Zero, some finite number, or even another infinity. So how do we handle this? How can we recover the fabulously accurate probabilistic predictions of quantum physics in the totally deterministic universe of the many worlds interpretation? How do we measure the infinite fraction of infinite outcomes in which you're reading this book? And what can it even mean to talk about probability in a world where literally anything that is physically possible actually occurs somewhere? The answer, or at least an answer, is that probability shows up in the many worlds interpretation because we're hopelessly lost. Although the universal wave function obeys the Schrödinger equation and splits in a deterministic way, we don't know where in that huge and complicated wave function we are. We know we're in only one branch of the universal wave function, but which one? After all, there are many copies of each of us scattered across a multitude of quantum worlds, each only slightly different. So it's not immediately obvious which world we're in. In particular, after conducting a quantum experiment, we know that we're in one and only one of the several worlds that the universe split into after the experiment concluded. But we can't know which of those worlds we're in without looking at the outcome of the experiment. We can't tell just by looking around us because all of those universes look identical otherwise. The best we can do is to use the mathematics of quantum physics to say how likely, how probable it is that we're currently in a particular branch of the wave function, which means we're assigning a probability to seeing a particular outcome of the experiment when we do look. So probability is still an essential part of quantum physics in the many worlds interpretation. It's just that the probability isn't, strictly speaking, about outcomes of experiments, but rather about where you find yourself in the universe right now. It's not clear whether this explanation actually works, though. It may be guilty of dualism, the idea that your mind is a non-physical entity somehow separate from your body. Nor is it clear whether this explanation also yields the specific probabilistic predictions of quantum physics. But it is a promising idea, one among several attempts to explain this problem. Figuring out how to calculate probabilities in an infinite multiverse is one of the most pressing problems both in modern inflationary cosmology and among those who subscribe to the many worlds interpretation. There are a variety of proposals for solving it, none of which have been widely accepted. Some of them invoke Everett's other great mathematical love, game theory, to answer the question. As with any open problem in science, there are no easy answers yet, but the consensus seems to be that the problem is not unequivocally solved, but that it probably can be solved, and either one of the existing promising solutions will turn out to be correct, or another will be found, hopefully soon. Despite the challenge that probability poses to the many worlds interpretation and other multiverse theories, the most frequent objection to the idea of a multiverse, be it quantum cosmological or stringy, is simply its profusion of worlds. It is hard to imagine a more radical violation of Occam's razor, the law of parsimony which urges scientists to keep entities to a minimum, complained Martin Gardner, the writer and recreational mathematician. But parsimony is in the eye of the beholder. Advocates of Everett's view point out that their interpretation of quantum physics requires far fewer assumptions than any other, and arguments from simplicity, by themselves, can easily lead science astray. There are many complicated scientific theories that are inarguably correct. Here's a multiverse that basically everyone believes in, says David Wallace, a philosopher and advocate of the multi-worlds interpretation. Think about the planets of the stars of distant galaxies. Pretty much everyone thinks that there are indeed planets around the stars in distant galaxies, and that there are rocks on the surface of those planets. That's not an infinite multiverse, but 10,000 billion billion solar systems is quite a lot to be getting on with, and the reason you take that seriously is not really because we can observe it. It's more that it's a completely unavoidable consequence of a theory that we think is just rock solid. Physicists attacking many worlds, or inflation or string theory, usually have a more serious objection to the idea of a multiverse. They denounce it as a prime example of unfalsifiability. This unwieldy word, a ghost of philosophy past, comes from the work of Karl Popper. Popper was a celebrated mid-20th century philosopher of science who spent most of his career at the London School of Economics. Popper had once held truck with the logical positivism of his native Vienna, but ultimately took an iconoclastic stance of his own. Rather than championing a verification theory of meaning, as the Vienna Circle had done, Popper promoted a scientific worldview based on falsification. Theories that could be proven false, Popper declared, were potentially scientific theories, and theories that could not be proven false were not scientific at all. Popper's views became unusually popular among practicing scientists, and by the end of the 20th century, many physicists believed that falsifiability was a vital acid test that any potential theory must pass. Viewed through this lens, any multiverse theory appears quite suspect. If the other universes are not accessible and can never directly influence our own universe, then what possible experimental data could falsify the theory that we live in a multiverse? And if no data could ever show the theory wrong, then how can it be an acceptable scientific theory? As the philosopher of science Karl Popper argued, a theory must be falsifiable to be scientific, wrote prominent cosmologists George Ellis and Joe Silk in a Nature editorial in 2014. These unprovable hypotheses, many worlds, string theory, and the inflationary multiverse, are quite different from those that relate directly to the real world and that are testable through observations, such as the standard model of particle physics and the existence of dark matter and dark energy. As we see it, theoretical physics risks becoming a no-man's land between mathematics, physics, and philosophy that does not truly meet the requirements of any. Straying from Popper's dictum, they warned, was a drastic step with potentially dire consequences. This battle for the heart and soul of physics is opening up at a time when scientific results, in topics from climate change to the theory of evolution, are being questioned by some politicians and religious fundamentalists. Potential damage to public confidence in science and to the nature of fundamental physics needs to be contained by deeper dialogue between scientists and philosophers. Yet if Ellis and Silk had bothered to engage in such a dialogue before writing their editorial, they would have learned that Popper's work hasn't been taken seriously by philosophers of science for decades, and with good reason. The idea that falsifiability marks the boundary of science is vulnerable to the same arguments that made the verification theory of meaning untenable, which we saw in Chapter 8. Just as individual beliefs can't be verified, as Quine pointed out in Two Dogmas of Empiricism, individual theories can't be falsified either, for much the same reason. Say Karl Popper's remote control isn't turning his television on, and he theorizes that the batteries in the remote are dead. so Popper runs down to the corner store, buys new batteries, and pops them into his remote. But the remote still doesn't turn the TV on. "Aha!" Popper exclaims. "My theory has been falsified." But it ain't necessarily so. Despite the fact that the remote still isn't working, it's still possible that the old batteries were dead. Maybe the new batteries are dead too. Maybe a rat gnawed through the TV's power cable while Popper was at the corner store. Maybe the laws of physics actually change depending on where you are. And while Popper was at the store, the solar system moved through its orbit around the center of the Milky Way and entered a patch of space where the laws of electromagnetism that govern the behavior of batteries in remote controls are different. The problem is that Popper's dead battery theory of his remote control doesn't actually make any predictions on its own. It only makes predictions in conjunction with a huge number of other basic assumptions that Popper has made about the functioning of the world. So Popper is wrong. His theory was not falsified. When the remote continued not to work, he could have rejected his theory about the dead batteries, or he could just as easily have rejected any of his other assumptions about the world. As Quine said, our beliefs about the world can only be tested against the world as a group, not individually. And this holds for falsification just as much as for verification. No theory, in isolation, is falsifiable. The history of science bears this out. When an experimental or observational result doesn't match a theoretical prediction, often one of the auxiliary assumptions used to generate the prediction is discarded, rather than the main theory itself. In 1781, John Herschel discovered Uranus, and astronomers of the time immediately set about predicting its motion using the cutting-edge science of Isaac Newton's gravitation and laws of motion. Over the course of the next few decades, as more observations poured in and calculations were refined, several astronomers realized that Uranus was not, in fact, moving as Newton's law of universal gravitation said it should be. But rather than throwing out Newtonian gravity as falsified by observation, they theorized that there was another, as yet unseen planet, even farther out than Uranus, that was causing the anomalies in Uranus's motion. One of these astronomers, Urbain Le Verrier, calculated exactly where to find this planet. And, in 1846, a group of German astronomers found Neptune, exactly where Le Verrier said it would be. So rather than being falsified, Newtonian gravity lived to fight another day. And when, several years later, Le Verrier and others noticed that Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, was not moving as it should, they once again did not throw out Newtonian gravity and instead postulated another new planet, so close into the sun that it was perpetually lost in its glare. They named this hypothetical scorched planet Vulcan, after the Roman god of the forge, and immediately set about looking for it. They hunted for it during solar eclipses, when the sun was masked by the moon. Several teams, including one led by Le Verrier himself, claimed to have found the elusive Vulcan, but the planet was never conclusively pinned down. Finally, in 1915, Albert Einstein proved Vulcan was a phantom. His new theory of general relativity explained the motion of Mercury perfectly, without invoking a new planet. Newtonian gravity had been wrong all along, but it took a new theory to displace it, rather than an alleged falsification. Even Popper understood that falsification couldn't be the acid test for scientific theories. He admitted that no theory could be falsified in isolation, but suggested that good scientists would reject their own theories rather than auxiliary hypotheses. But as the saga of Neptune and Vulcan shows, it is far from obvious when a theory should be discarded in light of conflicting evidence rather than rejecting some other assumption used to make the prediction. Claiming, then, that multiverse theories are unscientific because they are unfalsifiable is to reject them simply because they do not live up to an arbitrary standard that no scientific theory of any kind has ever met. claiming that no data could ever force the rejection of a multiverse theory is merely stating that a multiverse theory is just like any other theory, and claiming that there could never be any observable evidence in favor of a multiverse theory is to forget Einstein's admonition that it is the theory which decides what we can observe. Just as Grover Maxwell said in Chapter 8, what is considered observable can, and does, change over time, as scientific theories change. Atomic theory was once considered impossible to falsify, and atoms were once thought to be unobservable in principle. Evidence of a multiverse could share the same fate. Ultimately, arguments against a multiverse purportedly based on falsifiability are really arguments based on ignorance and taste. Some physicists are unaware of the history and philosophy of their own field and find multiverse theories unpalatable. But that does not mean that multiverse theories are unscientific. If scientific theories don't need to be falsifiable, what do they need to do? They need to give explanations, unify previously disparate concepts, and bear some relationship with the world around us. That's vague, of course, but science, like the people who do it and the world it describes, is complicated. Pat answers to complex questions, like Popper's cry of falsifiability, should always be suspicious. As H.L. Mencken once said, there is always a well-known solution to every human problem, neat, plausible, and wrong. What, then, is the right solution to the human problem of the Copenhagen interpretation? For, despite everything, despite pilot waves and many worlds, despite Bell and Bohm and Everett, despite the rise of quantum computing and the fall of logical positivism, Copenhagen is still dominant within physics. Copenhagen is still the view taught in every single popular introductory quantum physics textbook. There are still plenty of physicists who do not only prefer the Copenhagen interpretation, but think any other view is unscientific. Some even claim that Bell's theorem proves that the Copenhagen interpretation is the only possible consistent view. Quantum foundations is a much more respectable field than it once was, but it is still a small field, and there are still many physicists who have disdain for it. It's hard to find any jobs in quantum foundations, albeit not as hard as it was for John Clauser 50 years ago. And while the many-worlds interpretation is generally known to most physicists, many other views, such as pilot wave theory, are all but unheard of. How did we get here? Or rather, why are we still here? It's a good question. David Albert, the graduate student who nearly got kicked out of Rockefeller University back in Chapter 9 for having the temerity to question the Copenhagen interpretation, is now a professor of philosophy at Columbia University and has spent the past 40 years working in quantum foundations. "This is a really bizarre story," he said, summing up the history of this field. "You have, at the same time, the following two wildly contradictory things going on. The 20th century outstripped every other century for the number of smart people who were interested in physics and working actively on physics. That same century witnessed the longest period of psychotic denial of this deep, logical problem right at the center of this whole project." Psychotic might be overstating it, but it's pretty bizarre. Now that you've seen the whole story, now that you know how we got here, let's see just how weird things are now. 12. Outrageous Fortune. In the wooded foothills of the Austrian Alps, on the outskirts of Vienna, there is a hut in a vineyard with a small mirror in the window. The vineyard has been there for centuries. It was already old when one of the founders of the Vienna Circle, Otto Neurath, met with Einstein and other scientists on the neighboring hill in 1920 to discuss his idea of an international encyclopedia of unified science. The mirror is a newer addition. It was placed there in 2011 by graduate students at the Institute for Quantum Optics and Quantum Information of the University of Vienna as part of a long-distance quantum encryption network. The students, working for Professor Anton Zeilinger, shot photons at the mirror, one at a time, from their lab on the top floor of their building in the heart of Vienna, 5 kilometers away. On the roof of that building, a specially equipped telescope, named after Hedy Lamarr, the Viennese movie star and cryptography pioneer, remained trained on the mirror in the vineyard, carefully collecting the reflected packets of light after their passage through the turbulent air over Vienna. The feat, unimaginable outside of thought experiments for the founders of quantum theory, was merely a test. Right now, Zeilinger and his students are using this same equipment to exchange photons with a specially designed satellite in low Earth orbit, attempting to enable quantum encrypted communication between Vienna and Yunnan Astronomical Observatory in China, where physicist Zhang Weipan, a former student of Zeilinger, has a similar setup already in place. And if the past is any guide, they're likely to succeed. Zeilinger is an experimental master of photon manipulation. Zeilinger's group has already demonstrated that it can send and receive single photons over distances much longer than the 10 kilometers from the lab to the mirror in the vineyard and back. In 2012, they successfully sent entangled photons over 143 kilometers between La Palma and Tenerife in the Canary Islands. And Zeilinger has also spent decades conducting improved versions of Aspect's Bell experiments, verifying the existence of quantum non-locality with enormous experimental precision. Yet despite his intimate knowledge of the most bizarre aspects of the quantum world, Zeilinger has no qualms about the Copenhagen interpretation. The quantum state, as Heisenberg says, is a mathematical representation of our knowledge, said Zeilinger. It tells us the set of possible future measurement results, together with their probabilities. Measurement, for Zeilinger, plays a central role in quantum physics. There is no measurement problem, he claims. Measurement results live in the classical world, and the quantum state is what we call a quantum world, which is only a mathematical representation, according to Heisenberg. What you can talk about with your classical language, these are the objectively existing objects of the universe. These are the classical objects. And that's it. That's what can be talked about. The rest is mathematics. In other words, there are two worlds. A world of actually existing everyday objects, obeying classical pre-quantum physics, and a quantum world that isn't real in the same way, just as Heisenberg said. But Zeilinger doesn't think that there is a true boundary between them, some line beyond which quantum physics does not apply. There is no fundamental boundary, he said. There is a transition from classical to quantum, but that is not a boundary. It's not surprising that Zeilinger would say this. Almost no physicists still believe that there is any such fundamental boundary, and some of the most convincing work against such an idea came from Zeilinger himself. Back in 1999, Zeilinger and his collaborators managed to coax a buckyball, a collection of 60 carbon atoms in the shape of a soccer ball, to interfere with itself, like a photon in a double-slit experiment. Finding quantum effects in an object so much larger than an individual subatomic particle, though still about a billion times smaller than the objects in our everyday lives, might have been shocking to some of the founders of quantum physics. But Zeilinger, through his experimental work, has been determined to show that there is no limit to the validity of quantum physics. But this leaves a question. If only classical things exist objectively, yet quantum physics applies to everything, what is classical? More generally, how can we account for the world we see around us? According to Zeilinger, our everyday world is classical, but quantum physics must also accurately describe what we see in our everyday lives, because there's no boundary to its validity. How can we form a coherent picture of reality from this version of the Copenhagen interpretation? Zeilinger's answer to this question is unexpectedly simple. I don't know what you mean by that, he said. I don't think that you can even define it precisely. What the hell is going on here? Not all physicists agree with Zeilinger. The Copenhagen interpretation assumes a mysterious division between the microscopic world governed by quantum mechanics and a macroscopic world of measurement apparatus and observers that obeys classical physics, said Steven Weinberg, winner of the 1979 Nobel Prize in Physics. This is clearly unsatisfactory. If quantum mechanics applies to everything, then it must apply to a physicist's measurement apparatus and to physicists themselves. On the other hand, if quantum mechanics does not apply to everything, then we need to know where to draw the boundary of its area of validity. Does it apply only to systems that are not too large? Does it apply if a measurement is made by some automatic apparatus and no human reads the results? Gerhard Hooft, winner of the 1999 Nobel Prize in Physics, struck a more conciliatory note. I go along with everything Copenhagen says, except for one thing, and the one thing is you're not allowed to ask any questions, he says. Or to be more precise, there are certain questions you should not ask. I say, no, I'm going to ask them anyway. You don't want me to ask questions? Sorry. I have the strong impression that there is much more to say and that asking questions is useful. And Sir Anthony Leggett, winner of the 2003 Nobel Prize in Physics, said that he must make an awful concession. If you were to watch me by day, you would see me sitting at my desk solving Schrödinger's equation, exactly like my colleagues. But occasionally, at night, when the full moon is bright, I do what in the physics community is the intellectual equivalent of turning into a werewolf. I question whether quantum mechanics is the complete and ultimate truth about the physical universe. In particular, I question whether the superposition principle really can be extrapolated to the macroscopic level in the way required to generate the quantum measurement paradox. Worse, I am inclined to believe that at some point between the atom and the human brain, it not only may, but must break down. Yet Weinberg, Tehoft, and Leggett are exceptions among physicists. Views like Zeilinger's are far more common. There have been multiple informal surveys in the past 20 years asking physicists about their preferred interpretation of quantum physics. In most of these, the Copenhagen interpretation wins a commanding plurality of votes. And there is good reason to believe this seriously understates the support of Copenhagen among physicists, since these surveys are usually conducted at conferences on quantum foundations, creating a massive sample bias in the results. There are still a significant number of physicists who consider such conferences a waste of time, because they think that the Copenhagen interpretation sorted out all these problems long ago. Strangely, though, Zeilinger had difficulty recommending a reference that laid out the Copenhagen interpretation clearly. Maybe I or someone else should write a clear paper about quantum mechanics, he said. Part of the problem is that Bohr, the obvious choice, is fabulously and famously opaque. But there's a deeper reason underlying this difficulty. Copenhagen is no longer the dominant interpretation, said physicist-turned-historian Sam Schweber, who bailed out David Bohm back in Chapter 5. In the original old-school versions of the Copenhagen interpretation, classical objects like measurement devices couldn't be described with quantum physics, even in principle. But today, Schweber points out, nearly all physicists agree with Zeilinger that there are no such limits on quantum physics. Why, then, do so many physicists still think they subscribe to the Copenhagen interpretation? How can so many of them run blithely past the edge of the quantum cliff like Wile E. Coyote, not realizing just how far they have to fall? That's a different story, Schweber said. Part of the problem is that there is no single Copenhagen interpretation, and never really was. The name Copenhagen interpretation has gotten pretty slippery, said Nina Emery, a philosopher of physics at Mount Holyoke. The semantic confusion makes it easy for physicists to avoid dealing with those flaws directly. For instance, when you push them on the idea that measurements cause collapse, they shift and start talking about some kind of Bohrian view or about the mathematics of the theory. And if you point out the issues with those views, for example, who knows what the former is and the latter isn't even a complete interpretation, they go back to talking about measurements causing collapse. The flexibility afforded by these contradictory positions makes it easy to fend off any attacks on the Copenhagen interpretation. Physicists can simply hop from one position to another, sometimes without even realizing that they've done it. But if you're an instrumentalist, if you think that science is merely a tool for predicting the outcomes of experiments and nothing more, then this kind of hopping around isn't a problem, because questions of interpretation are pointless and unscientific anyhow. It doesn't matter whether you hold a single consistent position about the meaning of quantum theory. All that matters is what you can directly observe. These kinds of positivist-like ideas are still very popular among physicists, especially when the subject of quantum physics comes up. Zeilinger has suggested that the message of the quantum is the fairly positivist idea that the distinction between reality and our knowledge of reality, between reality and information, cannot be made. And the eminent physicist, Freeman Dyson, like Rosenfeld before him, has suggested that it may be impossible to observe any consequences of a theory of quantum gravity, which he claimed would imply that theories of quantum gravity are untestable and scientifically meaningless, in true positivist style. Yet philosophers have known for more than half a century that the positivism underpinning statements like these is fundamentally flawed. And philosophers of physics today almost unanimously reject the Copenhagen interpretation. Logical empiricism of a sort has made a comeback since 1980, but scientific realism is still the standard position among philosophers of physics. And even the most staunch defenders of empiricism today agree that the sort of naive positivism deployed in standard defenses of Copenhagen doesn't work. How have physicists failed to get the memo from philosophers after all this time? Part of the problem is that physicists generally don't know much about philosophy. There is a massive asymmetry between the two fields. While philosophers usually take physics very seriously indeed, philosophers of physics are mathematically conversant in physics, and often have advanced degrees in both fields. Physicists are rarely trained in philosophy at all, despite their ignorance of philosophy, or more likely because of their ignorance. Some physicists are openly contemptuous of the subject. "Philosophy is dead," declared Stephen Hawking in 2011. Philosophers have not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics. And according to Neil deGrasse Tyson, studying philosophy can really mess you up. Pretty much after quantum mechanics, philosophy has basically parted ways from the frontier of the physical science, Tyson claimed. I'm disappointed, because there is a lot of brain power there that might have otherwise contributed mightily, but today simply does not. Physicist Lawrence Krauss surmised that this antagonism between physics and philosophy comes from envy on the part of the philosophers. Because science progresses and philosophy doesn't, he claimed, philosophy is a field that unfortunately reminds me of that old Woody Allen joke. Those who can't do, teach, and those that can't teach, teach gym. And the worst part of philosophy is the philosophy of science. It's really hard to understand what justifies it. These are breathtakingly ignorant claims. Yet Hawking, Tyson, and Krauss are certainly not stupid people. Why do they know so little about philosophy? Their attitudes are even stranger when put in historical perspective. Just a few generations ago, at the birth of quantum physics, all physicists received some schooling in philosophy. Einstein read Mach, Bohr read Kant. But the shifts in research funding and physics classrooms after World War II also led to broader shifts in university curricula. For Einstein and Bohr's generation, philosophy was part of the core educational curriculum in Central Europe. But in post-war America, it was, and is, relatively easy for an intelligent student to go all the way from kindergarten to a PhD in physics at a top-tier university without ever darkening the door of a philosophy classroom. This is not a plea for the good old days. This problem isn't especially new. Even Einstein complained about this, and how it helped keep the Copenhagen interpretation entrenched. "This state of affairs will last for many more years," he wrote in 1951. "Mainly because physicists have no understanding of logical and philosophical arguments." And in most ways, education and access to education are far better now than they ever have been before. But with the massive increase in knowledge and information in the last century, education became unavoidably specialized. There's nothing wrong with that, but with specialization comes boundaries on knowledge, and good specialists understand that. Indeed, it's unlikely that Hawking, Tyson, or Krauss would issue strong pronouncements in many areas where they have no background, say, parasite ecology, or best practices in industrial sheet metal production. So why do they feel so comfortable saying so much about philosophy? Why is philosophy held in such contempt by many physicists and other scientists of all stripes? Philosophy has an image problem. Philosophers are thought to be mystics, religious figures, bullshit artists, anything divorced from reality. The discipline as a whole is seen as millennia of people chasing down big questions. What is the meaning of life? Why is there suffering? And coming back without any good answers. Philosophers of physics, and most other philosophers, are far removed from this picture. They work on well-defined questions with logical rigor and with input from the most recent developments in science and from the immediate experiences of the senses. How the practice and the image of philosophy have diverged so wildly is a subject for an entirely different book. But one part of the answer probably lies in the split between the two major branches of modern Western philosophy: analytic and continental philosophy. Those names are largely historical accidents and not relevant to their work. How the two branches split is a long and complex story. It has to do with the debate between the positivists and the German idealists, which we touched on in Chapter 8. But while most philosophers of physics are analytic, most of the philosophers from the past 70 years that you've heard of are probably continental. Continental philosophers like Sartre, Camus, Foucault, Derrida, and Zizek have become public figures, while very few analytic philosophers have done the same. And continental philosophers tend to be much more suspicious of scientific claims about knowledge and truth than are their analytic colleagues. Yet the distinction between the two kinds of philosophy is not apparent from a distance. Most scientists have never heard of the analytic continental divide. So, given that most of the highly visible philosophers in the public sphere today are continental, and given the attitude that some, not all, continental philosophers have towards science, it's not terribly surprising that scientists often have disdain for all philosophers, and sometimes even think that they can do philosophy better than the philosophers can. But there's more to it than this. Not all physicists who support the Copenhagen interpretation are merely ignorant of philosophy. Zeilinger has spent a great deal of time at conferences on quantum foundations with philosophers of physics, and is certainly aware of the history of positivism in his native Vienna. And it's not as if a deep commitment to positivism among a wide swath of physicists is driving support of the Copenhagen interpretation. If anything, it's the opposite. We physicists all learn some form of the Copenhagen interpretation in school, and many of us adopt it. And once you have that Copenhagen mindset, you'll probably be more favorably inclined toward positivism and related views. So perhaps it's not that physicists are eager to adopt positions that absolve them of responsibility for talking about reality. Perhaps it's merely that such positions become appealing once you've adopted Copenhagen's viewpoint. which leaves us back where we started. What's so appealing about the Copenhagen interpretation? If I were forced to sum up in one sentence what the Copenhagen interpretation says to me, wrote the physicist David Merman in 1989, it would be shut up and calculate. Merman followed his summary with a quick rejoinder, but I won't shut up. Yet the phrase shut up and calculate took on a life of its own after Merman set it to paper, and rapidly became the catchphrase of the Copenhagen interpretation among physicists. It was misattributed to Richard Feynman, and eventually even Merman himself forgot where it came from, only to rediscover years later that he was the source of the phrase. Shut up and calculate certainly doesn't sound appealing if you're not mathematically inclined. But even if you're a physicist, what's the virtue in shutting up and calculating? Merman himself provided the answer in his 1989 article. It is a fact about the quantum theory of paramount importance which ought to be emphasized in every popular and semi-popular exposition that it permits us to calculate measurable quantities with unprecedented precision. Quantum physics works. The calculations enabled by the theory are astonishing in their range of applicability and the accuracy of their results. Quantum physics tells us how long it will take to heat up your frying pan to cook your eggs, and how large a dying white dwarf star can be without collapsing. It reveals the exact shape of the double helix at the core of life. It tells us the age of the immortal cattle on the rock walls of Lascaux. It speaks of atoms split beneath the stone heart of Africa eons before Oppenheimer and the blinding light of Trinity. It predicts with uncanny accuracy the precise darkness of the blackest night. It shows us the history of the universe in a handful of dust. If shutting up is the price of doing these calculations, then pass the ball gag and break out the graph paper. But why is that the price? Why does Copenhagen require that you shut up in order to calculate? For that matter, how does the Copenhagen interpretation allow you to calculate at all? The measurement problem is so centrally tied to the core of quantum physics that, without some answer to the problem, it's impossible to use the theory. Some interpretation must guide you in the use of the mathematics, and Copenhagen, as we've seen many times over, offers no such solution and is not a true interpretation. So how can shutting up allow you to calculate anything? The form of the Copenhagen interpretation usually found in physics textbooks says, explicitly or otherwise, that measurement is a fundamentally different process from any other found in nature, and that measurement is defined as any time a large object encounters a small one. Large objects are simply assumed to obey classical physics, even as quantum physics is presented to the student as a more fundamental theory underpinning classical physics. In short, the student is implicitly asked to accept as part of the basic structure of quantum physics that there are two worlds, the classical and the quantum, just as Bohr taught. Yet at the same time, they're being told that quantum physics is the fundamental theory from which classical physics emerges. So quantum physics students are asked to swallow a contradiction. On the one hand, they're told that the idea of a classical object is logically prior to the idea of quantum physics, since the idea of a classical object is needed in order to figure out when a measurement has happened. But on the other hand, they're told that quantum physics is logically prior to classical physics, the latter emerging out of the former. These ideas can't both be right. And in practice, the version of the Copenhagen interpretation most commonly found in textbooks and in the wild values the first idea over the second. Some objects are just classical, and it's interaction with those objects that is defined as measurement for the purposes of quantum physics. Solving the measurement problem well enough to allow calculations to be performed. Certainly, most physicists, including yours truly, also believe that quantum physics underpins classical physics. But when actually performing quantum physics calculations, this fact is conveniently forgotten.